in this first quantum gravity seminar of the decade. And so...
Hopefully not the last.
So this year, I think Lee proposed that there would be a... We would start the year with a series of, I guess, three talks.
No, that was either Laurent or Bianca who proposed that.
Yeah, it's said that we would start with the three vision talks, and the first of which would be done by Ellie. And I guess it doesn't need any introductions here, so.
Great. Thank you. Can everybody hear me? Yes, good. So this has been there for a while, so I take it everybody's read it, and it's just to get us in the mood. And look, basically the situation is there are different approaches to quantum gravity that different people pursue. All of them have good points and things that make us think maybe that's the way the world is. And all of them by this time that have been pursued for more than a few years have worrying points, sticking points, problems that don't get solved year after year after year after year. So that in the end, or as of present, we're not very, nobody is super, super, there are people who are super, super confident that what they're doing must be right, but nobody is rationally super confident. And I think we should remind ourselves that this is for real, this is science, and there is no partial credit. There is alleged partial credit, like getting a lot of people to know your name and cite your papers and have a good career. And all that stuff isn't nothing, but compared to what we're really doing, what we're really aiming to do, the basic, let's behave like there is no partial credit. And spending decades on a research program that in the end doesn't have any experimental support is embarrassing. And I think we should, what Laurent and Bianca and I want to do by starting off this series of vision talks is focus everybody, inspire people, provoke people, but above all, let's get serious. When I went to my first postdoc with Cecile Moret-DeWitt and Bryce DeWitt in charge at the opening of the KITP, Bryce DeWitt said to us, behave as if this is the Manhattan Project to quantize gravity, and you've got 2 years or you're going to lose the war. So that's our message to you. Let's get serious.
2 years ago.
Because at the moment, the situation is quite confused. And I tried to find a picture of a ship having sunk in the storm. There are lifeboats floating around with people in different lifeboats. But you can imagine that. So I'll go on. Now, I started working in loop quantum gravity. I love loop quantum gravity. There's a long list of things that loop quantum gravity and spin foam models can do for us that suggest that at least they have the kinematics right for quantum theory of gravity. And I will keep coming back time after time to loop quantum gravity. But there are issues, and this talk is not about those issues, but I want to, as I think anybody who has been associated with the program for a long time should honestly do, stand up and tell us what your issues are. So there are things that we wish we understood better that some smart, dedicated people are trying really hard to do, like coarse graining and the renormalization group. My personal things I wish I understood how to do is represent chiral fermions in the theory, because I think that's an often overlooked necessity of a good quantum theory of gravity. And unification with the other forces is essential. But there are some serious weak points that we should focus on. All the approaches share the weak point that there are no unambiguous, clean predictions for doable experiments. While a number of people thinking more phenomenologically, like NIOSH, have predictions or expectations for experiments that could test ideas about quantum gravity, but they don't come from the well-worked through detailed theories. And I think there's a lesson there. More particularly in loop quantum gravity, there's no conception of energy quantum mechanically that does what energy usually does for a quantum system. There's no ground state. There's no exit. We know a lot about quantum geometry, but we don't know how to think of them in terms of excitations of a ground state. Hence, we're crippled when it comes to answering questions that most physicists would like us to answer. It's very easy for us to talk about quantum geometry and quantities that scale like h bar g, because as in any approach to quantizing general relativity, there's a 1 over h bar g sitting in front of the action, and if there's no matter, that's the only place h bar appears or g appears, that is together. So from that starting point, it's not surprising that we can't calculate anything that's proportional to h bar over g, or 1 over h bar over g, which would be something in units of the Planck energy. And almost anybody who wants to think about quantum gravity wants to think about effects in units of energy over the Planck energy. But we can't do that. And that's not small. And finally, I'm not going to dwell on these, but the description of Planck's space, fundamental space-time geometry that we get from spin foam models, it's beautiful, it's beautifully motivated, but it's complicated. You can't calculate anything with it, basically. Now, some people have some strategies, they have some ideas, but the research programs in quantum gravity that are doing the calculations that I would like to be doing are much simpler, and there's a lesson to be learned from that. Okay, that's all my kvetching.
Sorry, what is that BL? You said BL last time.
Too bloody complicated. So my personal view, just to say it because it's not worth anything and get it out of the way, I think there are aspects of the kinematics of loop quantum gravity that are compelling. And something like that, that is states built from graphs which carry labels of representations of some quantum group or quantum algebra, could really be the way the world works. I'm going to argue, and this is something that a number of people have been thinking about from very different points of view, that we have to, and it's not surprising given what I said before, that we have to get energy into the game. And a lot of people here and elsewhere have been thinking about boundary states and edge mode. And that is a way, what I like about that is the way to get energy in the game. I think there's something right about the close connections to conformal field theory and topological field theory, ladder of dimensions, conformal field theory in two dimensions, Trans-Simon in three and BF in four, is closely related to what's most beautiful in loop quantum gravity. And I think there's something right about that. But I think the dynamics is wrong, and it's not only wrong in detail, because, for example, we don't know how to compute the math. We don't know how to do a computation to show that our theory is gapless, speaking the language of most other physicists. And there's some people who proudly publish they have a Hamiltonian, and you look at the Hamiltonian, and there's a gap. So they have only massive gravitons, and that's not physics. So dynamics, for various reasons I'll talk about, I think is what, even if we love the kinematics, is what has to be rethought. John, hold the questions. I'll remember you have a question, I'll get to it. So when I stay up at 3 o'clock in the morning and wonder what could we do different, I try to think of what did the great people who invented theories in history do? And it may be just prejudice from the fact that philosophers and historians tell the story, and they like to think in terms of big ideas and principles. But the story you read in the history books of the invention of quantum mechanics and general relativity and special relativity and so forth has a lot of input from experiment, which we don't have. But it also talks, they talk a lot about principles in the early days. So I am saying to you what I said to myself, let's see how far we can get talking about principles. So let's forget the approaches. The approaches are models, whether it's string theory or causal dynamical triangulations. you're probably modeling some aspect of quantum gravity phenomenology that might be interesting or useful somewhere, some way. But we don't know what the principles of the theory we're looking for are. So let's try to go about it and construct possible candidate principles. So here's my present list. I keep a list. I wrote a paper about this about 3 years ago, and the list has changed. But before I get to the list, I see I put myself a slide here. This is what I propose to try to do, to start with principles, to build hypotheses about nature on those principles, and then to go directly to either phenomenology or model building. And only after we get a lot of experience with that, with those components, do we again try to invent a theory. But inventing a theory for me comes late. And phenomenology comes first, model building comes first, and those are all expressions of hypotheses and principles. So that.
Where is experiments here? Or is that
it's with phenomenology.
Arrow from phenomenology back to principles.
Yes. Thank you. And that's part of your job, but it's also my job.
Okay.
So to look for principles, I started trying to put the problem in context. Because one of the things I think we also get wrong is that there's a small number of major questions in fundamental physics and cosmology. And most often, specialists who attack one of them only attack one or maybe two. But I'll tell you, my guess is that they're all deeply related. So I think quantum foundations is highly important. I'll state my opinion. People in the room will hate me for it. I don't think we're going to get anywhere with quantum foundations in isolation. That is, anywhere in the sense of discovering new physics. And I don't think we're going to solve quantum gravity, again, my personal view, without making a revolution in quantum foundations. And I don't think we're going to solve any of the initial conditions problem, what chose the laws, the parameters of the laws, the initial conditions, without having great progress in quantum foundations and quantum gravity and unification. And certainly so for dark matter and dark energy. These are the main problems we face, and I think we should look for a connection between them. And all of this is setting up my proposal for principle. So first of all, I was educated both in quantum foundations and quantum field theory and quantum gravity. And the first thing that impressed me, and I've been wondering about this for most of my career, is that there's a challenge to the principle. If you ask a quantum field theorist what are the basic principles, they, of course, always say locality. But there are challenges to locality that come from quantum foundations and challenges to locality that come from quantum gravity. And I think those challenges are real. And the conclusion I draw from that is what's there, that space is emergent, locality is emergent. The distinction emergent means not in the list of, because Laurent said, don't use the word emergent too many times without defining it. Emergent means a property that's important for describing nature at some level that does not appear in the list of fundamental quantities or laws, but comes at a composite or more complex or larger length scale. So I think space is emergent in that sense, as I think that the fundamental theory we're looking for doesn't know anything and doesn't speak of space. And therefore, the distinction between locality and non-locality emerges when space emerges. And therefore, because we all know that this, like every good problem in science, is a problem in condensed matter physics, means we should expect that locality is disordered, like everything, every principle that emerges in condensed matter physics.
In some sense, you're bringing up, we don't know if there's not a notion of space and locality at the quantum level.
I agree. This is.
Otherwise, you could say classical mechanics is emergent, but then we know it's emergent from something which has structure, which resembles the one. So I think saying emergent is like giving up on trying to find what is the principle.
This is my turn, but I'm glad during my turn you state your view because I'll do the saying. So I simply disagree, and this is the conclusion I've come to. And I'd like to postpone argument of that kind because it's endless until after I've shown you the whole picture. And then I'm happy to discuss the whole picture. I have years and years and years of thought and argument that went this way for a while and now it goes this way. And I'm building a picture and I'm stating a view. Of course, it's criticizable, as are any of our views, because everything is tentative in the development of science. Okay.
When you say space, you're careful not to say space-time, is that right? You don't mean time?
I think that's true about space. What I've just said applies to space-time as well.
Okay.
But I have a few. We'll get there. Now, on the other side, a problem I've been taking seriously and thinking about since the middle 80s is the landscape problem. Because it occurred in string theory in 1986, 1987, even though it wasn't widely discussed for some reason until 2003, there is string theory is a beautiful theory of unification. We don't know if it's anything close to the truth, but it does unify in a beautiful way. And it a consequence of taking it seriously is that you have to believe there's a vast number of vacua or ground states which each give their own phenomenology. And so the problem, what chooses the phenomenology, what chooses the laws, what chooses the parameters of the laws, is one of our major problems in physics, I believe. And the conclusion I've come to, and again, different people come to different conclusions. The important thing is to, in my opinion, is to provoke us to think about it. The conclusion I've come to is the same conclusion that Charles Sanders Peirce came to when he, to my knowledge, was the first person to formulate the question in the 1890s. He's an American philosopher. And he said, the only way, he said, if you don't explain not just phenomena in terms of laws, but why the laws are the laws rather than different possible laws, you don't explain anything. And the only way to have an explanation of why these are the laws rather than other laws that is going to lead to science developing and propositions that are falsifiable and testable is if they're based on a dynamics of evolution of laws. That was Charles Sanders Peirce in 1893. The book is called The Architecture of Theories. And I rediscovered that idea, or re-fell upon it, and have been thinking about that ever since. So the idea that laws evolve is part of the baggage or the whatever that I travel with. And the idea that that implies that time is real, that is more fundamental than the laws themselves that express relations in time, is an important idea for me. Again, I imagine most of you disagree.
I just want to cover, if the laws are evolving according to some laws,
then we have the meta-law dilemma.
Then you have a meta-law dilemma, you haven't really got yourself anywhere. So what you're actually advocating is some kind of anarchy in the way the laws evolve?
No, I'm advocating transcending the meta-law dilemma. And I can switch to that talk. I wrote a whole book with the philosophers, you know, very well about that dilemma, which we almost called the meta-law dilemma. So I have talks in this computer where I can switch to that and show you some strategies for overcoming the meta-law dilemma. But just let me just state that I believe it can be overcome. We can come back to it. Okay, so here's where I'm coming from. Time, and again, you will have different places where you're coming from. I'm not giving this talk because I want everybody to jump up and say, oh, I'm going along the same way. But I seriously think you all should think about the same issues and come to your conclusions and commitments that will color your research. So my belief, after a lot of thought, is that time is fundamental and irreversible. Causality is fundamental, And if you want to know what that means, Marina was a huge influence in getting this drained out. And then we wrote a bunch of papers, so we can refer you to those papers and you can see, and I'll come back to it, what exactly we mean when we say causality is fundamental. Space is not fundamental. Locality is emergent and disordered. We just mentioned that. Laws of nature evolve. My view on quantum foundations is that it's a physics problem, which means I think the problem is to complete an incomplete theory. And that the task of doing that is very much entangled, to use a bad choice of words, with the problems of quantum gravity, the problems of how the laws evolve, and so forth. So that's where I'm coming from.
You talk about space, but you don't talk about the dual variable, energy. So is energy, if space is not fundamental?
Energy is fundamental? Energy is waiting in the wings to have her appearance.
So is it, but for you, is it fundamental or not?
Yes, and I've written into the play a beautiful entrance for energy. Because energy, because one of the things I think we agree is that if it doesn't have energy and momentum, it's not physics. The most important thing we know about nature is that they're not just arbitrary differential equations. There are conserved physical quantities, most importantly, energy and momentum. Don't we agree about this? Which are have to be the center of the story. I'm just delaying the appearance of it.
But if energy is fundamental, what about the conjugate of the energy?
That's exactly where we're going. So here are the principles. I'm sorry there are five of them and the abstract said four. But they fluctuate and the number fluctuates. And I have something to say about each of them. I don't have the complete job worked out of starting with these and getting to, by the way, what do we want to get to from the principles? If you go back to that chart I showed, we want to get to models which exhibit the principles and let us study them. And we want to try to get directly to phenomenology to study them. So I'm going to talk about mostly the first three. By the way, Laurent is the person more than anybody else who got me to take duality seriously. So duality is a relatively recent entry on my list of principles. But you'll see, and I don't use it the way you use it. In fact, I use it the opposite way, but we'll see.
Are you going to define what you mean by weak holography?
Yes, okay. If I get there. And again, I can refer you to three or four papers back in the 90s when I went through that issue in detail and defined weak holography separate from the strong version. And so the first one is relationalism. And I specify further, because of my commitment to time being real and causation being real, what I mean by relationalism is slightly different than, say, what Julian Barber or Harlow thinks relationalism is. This is relationalism where all the relations, which are the things, relationalism says that the properties of the entities in physics are not intrinsic to those entities, but they're about relationships between them and other entities or interactions. And an atemporal relationship, like Julian Barber, is one that exists prior to time. And Julian thinks that they all exist prior to time. And this is the opposite, because I'm committed to time being the only thing that exists and goes deepest, fundamentally, that all the relationships are based on causal relationships and tense relationships, like before, after, past, present, future. These are all legitimate relationships. A good relationalist has read at least a few pages of Leibniz over and over and over and over again. And there are two principles that Leibniz emphasized, the principle of sufficient reason and the principle of the identity of the indiscernible. The first is a little vague, and the way I understand it, which may not be scholarly, is that you should answer as many questions as you can of the form, why is the world like this, rather than like some alternative. And that every time you can state a fact about the world that imagines an alternative state, there's a question, why is it like this and not like that? And you should look to make progress in science by answering those questions. I'm not going to make a commitment about whether we ultimately get to answer them all, but we should try. And then there's a beautiful example of how Leibniz got to the idea that there's no absolute space, by realizing that if there was absolute space, why it's here and not there, why it's stationary here rather than rotating there, would lead to questions of this kind that had no answer. So requiring that these questions have answers leads you to conclusions like there's no absolute space, there's no absolute time. The principle of the identity of the indiscernible is, to me, very relevant for contemporary and modern physics. It says that there are no two events whose view, and that's a word that I'm introducing and underlying because that's going to be important in what I have to say, is identical. The view of an event is what you see about the rest of the universe from that event. In other words, what information comes up your backward light cone, if you're a classical relativist. But in any system of relations described in terms of graphs and flows along graphs, whether it's geography or urban planning or chemistry or biology or physics, there are entities and the entities have neighborhoods that they interact with. And that's your view of the universe, is the interactions with your neighbors. And the principle of identity of indiscernible says that fundamentally, there are no two events or entities with the same neighborhood, with the same view of the rest of the world. And that's very strong. But I think that that's, as you'll see, that's an important principle, and we get a lot of mileage out of it. Okay. The emphasis, one of the implications of that is that there's no global symmetry. And there's more than one point of view about fundamental physics that leads to the conclusion that there are no global symmetries. There's an argument through string theory and M theory that there are no global symmetries that somebody else can remember. I don't remember at the moment. Karol Kukoc has a theorem in general relativity with cosmological, that is closed boundary conditions. There are no Killing fields or conformal Killing fields on the actual configuration space, on the physical configuration space. That's a theorem from the early 70s. There are a lot of different ways where you come to the conclusion that there are no global symmetries. And this principle endorses that, because if there's a global symmetry, there are two events which are related by the global symmetry, which have exactly the same view of the universe. So this perspective focuses our thinking, in my opinion, on something that fundamental physics usually takes us away from. Fundamental physics usually points us to want more symmetries and more things which are transformable into each other. And this is exactly the opposite. The fundamental idea is that the fundamental events that make up the history of the world are each one unique, each and every single one unique. And I should emphasize right away that that's not my idea. I learned that from Roger Penrose, from one of the early talks that I heard from him. Okay. So some other consequences of this, no fundamental symmetries, the whole blah, blah, blah about background independence is an application of these principles. And I think it's strongly important. That is, I'm not interested in a proposal for a quantum theory of gravity that has some fixed non-dynamical background of fields or geometry or algebra that is not itself subject to dynamics. Because I think the part of the project of quantum gravity is making a cosmological theory. And a cosmological theory is one that's about a system which is closed and all of its causes are contained within itself. If there's something of what we call background structure, like a fixed frame, or a fixed field or a fixed metric that really represents the influence of something outside the closed system. And I think we should and can do without it. And general relativity is an example of how to do without it in the domain. And again, these are always, because I'm a physicist and I'm not a scholar, matters of degrees. General relativity has some background structure, like the topology and the differential structure and the dimension and so forth, but it has less background structure than Newtonian dynamics. And there's some other things that I think I've said enough about relationalism. You get the drift. The next principle is causation. And that's really, the first is a kind of methodological principle. So this is some of the structure that's in making these lists. The first is always a methodological principle, largely. The second is always where you put your big ontological statement. And the big ontological statement is that the ontology of the world is events and their causal relations, fundamentally, and a few other things. And this is where, ta-da, energy and momentum enter. So you have to make a list. We're on the way to making a list of principles that's going to include some hypotheses that hopefully will, after a long period of development, maybe leave us with a theory. And these are hypotheses. In addition to the basic picture that events and their causal relations are real, I am proposing that energy, momentum, and a number of other things are fundamental. And so, a brief moment, Laurent, again, this is the answer to what you were asking. I think we have to give a moment to the fundamental pairing that makes physics physics, which is space or position versus energy, temporal duration versus momentum, space versus momentum, and time versus energy. And I am taking the view that I'm interested in the most parsimonious approach to physics. So I want to choose half. And there's another reason I want to choose half, which should be immediately evident, which is it means that you're completing quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, with the uncertainty relations or the commutation relations that define quantum mechanics, involve both members of the pair. If there's a level where only one member of each pair exists, you've gone beyond quantum mechanics. And that's part of what I want to do. So I want to choose either a theory where there's time and space, and energy and momentum are, quote, emergent, which Noether's theorem promises us we should be able to do if we have a situation with symmetries, or the reverse. And really, this started just to see where it went. Let's start with the reverse. Let's take energy and momentum as fundamental, and all the way down, present, and position and time to be coming later. So the world that we're describing has events which are related by causal processes, and those causal processes carry with them energy and momentum, and maybe some other quantum numbers. But they don't live in space or space-time. So you get dualities, but the dualities are the result of emergence. And what I'm going to show you exactly, there are two things that I believe I understand about the way that we start with energy and momentum and space-time emerge, and I'm going to get to tell you about just one of them in the time that I've got left. But that's my commitment, that's my responsibility. Start with energy and momentum and causal processes. No space, no space-time, they don't live anywhere. And look for a way that the description in terms of space and space-time, which is certainly real, nobody's arguing about what's real, just whether it's fundamental and in the fundamental laws, or whether it's emergent in like temperature and pressure and density, something that comes later and describes coarse grain situation.
So, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So in generativity, energy is not well defined. So in what sense then do you want it to be fundamental?
That's an excellent question. And I'm going to duck the question generally because my real answer is pragmatic. I'd be happy to, and I'm happy to play with this different ways, but I'm going to show you models which are closer to mechanics than general relativity, where I'm allowed to talk about what momentum and energy are. But hold that. That's an important question. So I think we get dualities between fundamental things that are posited to be fundamental and things that are paired with them and emerge appropriately. What it means to be paired, yes.
Sorry, I don't know what do you mean by an extended structure?
I mean things like loop surfaces thought of topologically. And those are dual to fields that we integrate over them. So loops to gauge fields and membranes to surfaces and so forth. Yes.
Lee, I'm worried that time seems to have moved back and forth.
Oh, so let me make a distinction, because there are, as Carlo reminds us, there are many meanings of time. So when I say time is fundamental, I mean in the sense that the world consists of events, and those events, there's a process, there's always a present set of events, and there's a process which acts on those events to bring us new events, which become, as Henri Bergson would like to say. When I say that time, as in I always talk about space-time, is emergent, I mean as measured and defined as a result of measurements made with light signals and clocks. So that is different.
Lee, just clarify. So is this notion of time equivalent to just a change, or is more loaded? Is there something?
Depends on how much you want to load down change. It's more in the models, so a lot of the specificity of this outcome came from a series of models that we developed with Marina. And in those models, there is some additional structure which comes out, we don't put in, which comes out like the present turns out to be thick. That is, the class of events that we call present includes pairs of events that are causally related. Okay. Good. Let me go on. So because my strategy is that I'm throwing out of fundamental physics half of each canonical pair, I no longer have quantum mechanics. I have something that we call half quantum mechanics, which I'll come to, from which we hope to get quantum mechanics. And I'm very, Laurent, you made me very self-conscious, because it's true, I feel like every time I use the word emergent, everybody should stand up. And because I use it a lot, but I think I have very specific meanings, which I'll show. Okay. So that's what we have to say about duality. It's emergent, I'm sorry. And I'm going to stop there and talk about those three principles. And then I'll come back if there's time and talk about weak holography and the quantum equivalence principle. The first and second, to study them, we defined with Marina and studied over, Marina, how many papers? 8 papers, something like that?
Many papers, what?
We devoted to the energetic causal set. Anyway, we spent a lot of time on them. And they're a very simple model that turns out to have a lot of content. And they are models of what I think we mean by the first two principles. So they're worth studying not as a candidate for a fundamental theory necessarily, but as a model, and I'll have something to say about them. Number one, three, and four, that is the temporal relationalism, not causation usually, but emergent duality in the sense of identifying gauge fields with extended objects, and weak holography are consequences of loop quantum gravity. And that is therefore a model of one, three, and four. So part of my strategy will be to put those two models together, and we have something to say about that. Not very much so far. Yes?
Sorry, I feel like there are several meanings to the word duality. What exactly do you mean by duality?
Two objects which are in a complementary relationship, like position and momentum. That's not a very, I understand it.
In general,
such that you can describe some aspects of the world purely in terms of one or in terms of the other. For example, quantum gauge fields we can describe in terms of functionals of the gauge fields or by giving a dynamics to loops and networks. Okay. So that's my strategy. Moment. Is everybody with me? I will. Okay, I've got enough time. We've talked about energetic causal sets a bunch here, so I'll go quickly through the definition just because it'll let me make some claims about it. So the assertions, to summarize, are that the world is made up of events, causal relations. Time is the process which continually brings into being new events. So there is a part of the, quote, laws in this model are an algorithm which picks out at every time step a number of events and makes them the predecessors or the parents of a newly created event. And these events are endowed with some considered quantities, like energy and momentum, and they flow all across the causal relation. So that's, Raphael is somewhere, is way in the back. Raphael and collaborators have discussed causal sets, which are just events and causal relations. Our events have labeled by momenta, and the causal relations carry momenta. One of the things to note is that, and this is preparatory for work that we have not yet done in detail, but the momentum coming out, if you look at the initial event J, that has a momentum coming out QJ to I along a causal relation, which is J to I. And when it arrives at I, it has momentum P. And Q is not necessarily equal to P. We anticipate putting in parallel transport gauge fields that will act exactly there. And when we do that, which we haven't done, we'll be talking about something related to general relativity. But we're not. That's in the merging of loop quantum gravity in this structure. And we impose that at each event, the total momentum energy in is the total momentum energy out. So these have two kinds of dynamics. There's the algorithm I mentioned, which is the event generator, which follows some algorithm, which I'll be telling you examples of, to choose what will be the parents of the new event. And then once we've constructed the new event, there's an action principle which realizes the number of constraints, which propagates the energy and momentum to the new event on the new causal relations. So keep those in mind. Now, and part of the definition of the models is that each new event has a certain fixed number of parents, and each parent can be a parent to a fixed number of events. And so you're a present event while you still have the capacity to be a parent, that is, you still have a capacity to be a progenitor to a new event, which will then be part of influencing the future. Okay, so that's the basic idea. There are three kinds of constraints. There's the parallel transport I mentioned, the conservation I mentioned, and then we impose energy-momentum relations on the energy-momentum vector. And that's the theory. There's no space-time. There is a geometry, and that geometry is the geometry of the space of momentum. And I should say that this work, some of the structures are common with relative locality, the way in which in relative locality we set up dynamics in momentum space. This is a dynamics which works in momentum space. And there's no need to mention space-time. So the action is a sum of constraints. And when we work out the equations of motion, we study the action. We impose the constraints by means of canonical, usual Lagrange multipliers. And the PI is the conservation constraint. And its Lagrange multiplier Z lives in the dual space of momentum space, which turns out to be where space-time emerges from. So if we start working out equations of motion, and I'm not going to go through this in detail, we've talked about this here. But the equations of motion include, if you see the equation Z, we have a causal link in red there, PKI, which is the momentum carried along the link from the event ZK to the event ZI. And Z are the values of the Lagrange multipliers. And when the equations of motion are satisfied, the interval between ZI and ZK is related to P. If P is null, that interval is null. So in this way, by solving the equations of motion, the space of the Lagrange multipliers, which are just some numbers, is endowed with a geometry, which is the dual geometry of momentum space. And that's the sense in which, by solving the classical theory, an embedding in space-time, quote, emerges. Okay? Now, often it doesn't work completely. There are inconsistencies in the relations, and you don't get a simple Lorentzian space-time. But sometimes you do, and when you do, when all the equations of motion are consistent with each other, then you can say that really a Lorentzian space-time has emerged. Okay. Let me also note that the Zs have dimension of inverse momentum. So if we'd like to talk about length and distance, we need to change the quantities that we study. We need to change the units of measurements. And that's where H bar first is introduced as a conversion factor. Okay, now that sets up what we want to say next, which is just one way, and there are several ways we've studied, where something like quantum theory emerges from something that's not quantum theory. And this is in the second paper we wrote with Marina on energetic causal sets. And it's really a very simple remark, and I wouldn't be surprised if somebody made it somewhere. We call it half quantum theory. This theory has the structure of a pure path integral approach to quantum theory. It has amplitudes for processes. A process is a series of interactions of the kind we've talked about, a series of events connected by causal relations. There is an amplitude for each event, and then the amplitude for the whole process is the product of the amplitudes for the events. So we take that from quantum theory, we start with some ingoing events which have ingoing momenta and outgoing events which have outgoing momenta. We have all the ways to go from the incoming states to the outgoing states. We sum over them. We sum over all the intermediate variables, and that's an amplitude, and we square it, and we get the probability. That's just like quantum mechanics. What's not like quantum mechanics is that there's no space-time, there's no positions, there's no durations. There's no H-bar, there's no canonical commutation relations. We've just got half the degrees of freedom of quantum mechanics. But we still can talk about amplitudes and do all the things that we're used to doing with amplitudes. And that's sort of interesting because this is a quantum theory, in quotes, in which everybody gets to be a beable. There's no uncertainty principle, there's no commutation relation. Yes.
Because your action depends on the momenta, you do need something to create a weight which is dimensionless. There's no H bar, but there must be a parameter that.
Well, so just, it's an obvious trick, and again, I'm very surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if the trick was known under some other words. You can write the formula for the amplitude like I've written at the top. I'm integrating over the internal momenta. I have delta functions for the constraints, and that's it.
No, the amplitude. Can you go back to what you
mean?
It's a dimensionless number that depends on the momenta.
The constraints.
The energy scale.
Very good.
There's no H bar, but there's a fundamental.
Well, at the moment, there's no length scale. But you're telling me to write delta of p, I have to write delta of p over some p zero.
I'm talking about the AI. What is your AI? It's a function of p.
Oh, AI is going to be one in everything I do, and then it's going to be a measure of complexity. But what I think the lesson that you want me to learn here, I'm about to learn. So let me go ahead. I then do the obvious thing, and I represent those delta functions. Do you agree that theory is well defined? That's the path integral, which is well defined. If I want to compute it, it's awfully helpful to introduce Lagrange multipliers and exponentiate the delta functions. But then I've got conventional quantum mechanics for relativistic particles. And the Lagrange multipliers turn out to be the positions in space-time of the events that originally were defined without being anywhere in space-time. So it's a very simple game. Of course, you can make it more complicated by putting on an amplitude for the events themselves. And again, that's something I'm coming to if I get there. Okay, do you see the trick? It's just a trick, but maybe it's worth thinking about as an example of how we could do something that is simpler than quantum mechanics, that at least at the semi-classical level, quantum mechanics emerges from. And yes.
So in principle, you use some kind of Fourier transform. And that means instead of writing
Yeah.
But I can also start with my geometry and rewrite through a Fourier transform.
No, of course.
And then I get something which is an energy momentum possibly.
Yes, of course.
And I would still say that I haven't reinvented quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is emerging from that. Just writing using different variables.
Well,
I mean, at some point, of course, there's a subtle thing. What is initial action you write? Basically, you could also get to this energy momentum possibly. Even with these constraints you get by starting from the usual.
Yes, of course.
Geometry possibly.
So I find that suggestive. And this is a toy model, but I find that suggestive of supporting the hypothesis that we live in a world in which energy and momentum are more fundamental than position and space-time.
Why is that? I mean,
because you can reformulate the theory so that, because you can reformulate the theory in a language in which the notions of positions and space-time never arises. And that's, we're waving our arms around. Let me go ahead.
You could also start with your geometry, the notion of energy and
understanding.
Yes, yes.
It's not put in, but you get it because.
But no, oh, okay, no, I understand. In this simple toy model, I could start it from somewhere else and draw the opposite conclusion. But now I can play with this toy, and in two steps, I can have it be something that doesn't have the symmetry that you're using. So let me see if I get that far. That there's an underlying duality between momentum space and position space. Of course it's symplectic geometry, but the question is what you hold, what you're using as a starting point to go deeper.
Just I draw it. Since we are talking about principles.
Please.
It seems to me that in order to be coherent with all the principles that you are choosing, talking about adjacency, so talking about position in space, seems more coherent than choosing to introduce energy. So I'm with
Lily, can I think when you mean from out, you mean in the UV, some sense in the UV or the UV, right? We have already measures of energy momentum in the UV.
I think that
by fundamental you mean.
I don't necessarily mean in the UV, no, because there are...
It's at least in the UV, it's obvious that it's in our current picture.
Okay, let me see. I've got about 5 minutes. So let me go one or two more steps, and then... I have 80 slides, but I didn't plan to get to this. So I found it very interesting when thinking about the structure to switch ontologies, to go from the ontology of events and the causal relations and the quantities which are conserved by the causal relations to an ontology of views. And again, this is for the scholars. This is inspired by Leibniz. Leibniz uses this language. Leibniz talks about the view of an event. And I used the word before, it's what information you have about your relationship to the rest of the universe at that event.
Is the view and the event different, ontology?
Because the view and the event are not different. What's different is the event and the causal relation, and what labels the causal relation versus just giving the view. So now I'm going to say, our universe consists of a set of views. A view is what's seen from that event. That is the two-sphere, which is the directions that light rays or quanta come in, labeled by the energy they carry. And I'm going to see if I can formulate all of physics in terms of just these views. So this is just different ways of saying it. In the energetic causal sets, and indeed in many different points of view, a view is a two-sphere with degrees of freedom painted on it. They can be punctures. The punctures have labels that tell you about the quanta that are incoming to the event. And that connects, as people who know about conformal field theory and Schoen-Simons theory, that connects to a whole toolkit of mathematics we can use to analyze the event, the views. Now, let me say what I want to do with these views, because I don't have time to go through the whole reformulation. What I want to do is formulate dynamics entirely in terms of the views. And to do that, I'm past the point where it's useful to make the transform back to space-time. I have to make use of the information available in these views. And so what I need to do, or what I find I can do, is talk about the difference between views. That is, there's a space of views. If I think about punctured surfaces of the kind I was just talking about, I can think about, again, as I would in Chern-Simons theory, or equivalently the boundary of loop quantum gravity, I can talk about the space of flat connections of some SU2 or some algebra on the punctured two-sphere, and I can have a metric on that, on those bundles, on those spaces. And I can talk about a difference function between the views. And then I can, knowing the difference, okay, let me just say this in words, because it comes about 10 slides later and I'm not going to get there. I can write a function which measures the diversity of the views. It sums over every pair of views and takes their difference and adds those differences up. And the larger that function is, the more diverse is the universe as described in terms of the views. And so that's called the variety of the system described by the views. And one of the, and I see people are leaving, so I'll close with this. One of the results that we have is that under a suitable definition, and this is why I can't do more than say this, this function, the variety, turns into the Bohmian potential, which distinguishes, in David Bohm's theory, the dynamics of the wave function from the dynamics of a classical probability ensemble. So this function, which measures the diversity of the views in the space-time, turns out to map directly to Bohmian quantum mechanics, and therefore to have this framework as a completion for quantum mechanics. Okay, let me just sum up by what I didn't get to talk about. I'm just now at weak holography, so I didn't get to talk about weak holography. But by weak holography, I mean the assertion that there's a relationship between the area of that two surface I've just been talking about, as defined in a quantum theory of gravity, and the dimension of the Hilbert space of the space of views, distinct views on that two-sphere. And I claim that that is a result in loop quantum gravity, given appropriate boundary conditions for horizons. That's something we've known for 25 or more years. And that it functions that way in the theory I'm constructing as well. Then the last principle is the quantum equivalence principle. It's the toughest to formulate precisely and in a language which is consistent with everything that came before. And so if I had more time, I would be telling you about how to formulate those two principles, and then attempts to derive both phenomenology and models from those principles. So I thank you, and I'll stop here. John.
Yeah. Well, you made a statement earlier that it's difficult to formulate predictions that can be compared with experiments. To my point, I would like to point out what experiments. Since Galileo and Newton, we've learned to make that if we make progress in physics, we need experiment data to guide us.
So let me add, John.
Just a minute. I know that I know quantum gravity data.
That's John. You've been coming to these seminars for close to 20 years. And every time you say that, I give you a list of quantum gravity experiments. And you come back a few months later and you say the same thing. So ultraviolet experiments having to do with cosmic rays, gamma ray bursts, synchrotron radiation are all tests of Lorentz invariance at energies close to order Planck energy. I also, as a number of people have done, is showed that some aspects of modified gravity theories are consequences of formulations of the equivalence principle to allow for quantum mechanics. And there are predictions that come from those. So those are two areas.
Oh, but the problem is that these are not, if you calculate a scattering amplitude up to just quantum gravity theory, somehow, you can't test it with experimental data the way you do in particle physics.
That's true.
So it's difficult.
So that's why I'm not.
One theory is better than another.
It's phenomenology, these things.
Yeah, but what phenomenon?
Black holes, for instance, explosion of black holes. Different theories will give you different time for this explosion, for instance.
Go ahead.
But the thing is that, of course, as Lee was noticing at the beginning, unfortunately, we don't have one experiment that will just put a divide between right and wrong. I mean, when we do physics, it's not like, okay, we pile up evidences and we follow traces. So I think there are, so for instance, the fact that in these days we have more and more evidence that Lorentz invariance is not violated up to a very high energy.
Let me give you a
No, it's a guidance, it's a principle,
said,
the way in which you construct it.
Let me mention why.
We move on because it's always the same question, same discussion. We don't have experiment for quantum gravity. That doesn't mean that we should not look for quantum gravity theory to get new experiments. because we keep having the same discussion.
Okay,
we have other questions?
John, in cosmology, we were not even called physicists for many decades. We called mathematicians because there was no data. So cosmology was in this exact state for many decades before we started having real cosmology, COBE and everything that, and now we're in the era of precision cosmology. But my teacher at the university said, when he wanted to go and study general relativity, they told him that's not physics, that's mathematics, and could never be tested. So I think we're very lucky in our field that there's this data popping up from every corner. But I mean, I think this is also important, and it's so difficult.
I agree that I'm not saying it's never going to happen.
Exactly. So
it
can we
happen yet after 80 years?
Can I mention? Let me call on the chair. Can we move the discussion forward? And Lingwen.
Question. So, what's the quantum means in this fifth principle? Quantum principle since fields like quantum.
Yes, I know. I know.
That's one formulation of it that I've tried. That we take it as given that a detector in arbitrary motion in the vacuum is thermally excited. And we take it as an experimental fact that there are motions for which the temperature of that thermal excitation vanishes. The principle is that those coincide with the inertial motion. So that's one way to state a quantum equivalence principle. And it says something which appears to be a coincidence, and indeed we impose on our theories, that one might hope had a deeper explanation, which is that those motions for a detector where the thermometer remains at zero, the calorimeter remains at zero, are the same as the inertial motions that Newton and Galileo discovered. Because you can easily write down forms of quantum field theory where it's not true. Yeah.
You mentioned at the beginning the different approaches to quantum gravity, and you said they all have some merit. So I wonder how you arrived at your principles, by what kind, and more generally, what kind of argument is convincing enough to make you discard some kind of principle and accept another one?
That's an excellent question. For me, the important theme, you're asking an autobiographical question, so I'll make it very short because this is not an autobiographical talk. But I find that thinking about things for a really long time helps. whether that really long time is focused in a few weeks or months, really focusing and coming back and back to something, even if it makes you feel dumb, is really necessary. I was trained as a high energy theorist, a gauge field theorist. When I first encountered what was called the problem of time in quantum gravity or quantum cosmology and the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, so forth, which I had the honor to be told about by both Johnny Wheeler and Bryce DeWitt, I took their point of view that time was not in the fundamental equation, but it was emergent. And it took a very long time to change my mind about that. And what influenced me was the lack of results of certain kinds, the lack of, that is, we were following the orthodox Dirac quantization program. And there were some results that were very easy that were supposed to be hard. And there were other results that were supposed to be straightforward that we could never get. So that bothered me. So most of it was thinking about the problem of what chose the laws of physics. That thinking about that issue, which seems utterly unrelated to quantum gravity, has been the most influential thing in my career. And finally, interacting with Roberto Mangabeira Unger, who is a very good philosopher and took me to task for believing inconsistent things. That is, for some days of the week working on the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, and other days of the week studying ideas about how the parameters of the laws might apply. So I'm happy to tell you the autobiographical story sometime, but the basic thing is that I think it's a combination of focus and intuition. But focus is, I find it's really useful to get to the place where you feel really dumb, if you know what that means, where you're really confused and all of the tools in your toolkit don't seem to be able to get you from A to B. And
you could hope for something more rigorous, or to, so it mainly seems to be based on intuition, or trying out something and noticing it doesn't work and then try another in the case of time.
But I'm not claiming too much. I mean, look, the idea of the equivalence principle is central to our understanding of gravity is central. It's hard to imagine that we would have a theory of gravity at any level that didn't incorporate some version of the equivalence principle. I think that if you think through what Bekenstein and Unruh and Hawking and Davies and all those people discovered, you come to the point of view that there is something different about gravity and thermodynamics. Something is trying to tell us something. And so the idea that there should be some statement of that in the list of principles, this is again, is not that outlandish. Then there's a long, long discussion because there are different forms. And there's the ADS-CFT kind of forms, but if you look in detail, there are different statements that you might make about ADS-CFT. And then there's already in the literature, you start to read different, slightly different, very different ways of stating the Bekenstein bounds of the holographic principle. So in the 90s, I spent a lot of time sorting through what was available then, which is, of course, different than what's available. Much more is available now. And I fought my way to a view, which in another talk I'll present.
Can you explain, in your view, how you envision the relationship between the weak holography principle and the first three?
So here's the steps, and some of this has been in some papers and some of it is not. You want to take the language of the causal sense and learn to speak within the language of discrete causal sets of the physical objects that are involved, the ones that come from thermal physics and quantum field theory. So for me, the route that I like to take is to construct a more general definition of causal diamonds, which is just kind of combinatorial, so you can have a work with the causal diamonds and the waste of the causal diamond outstates the instates and makes statements about them. So there's a lot of tool making to bring into, to let you speak the language of quantum field theory and thermal field theory.
I was more asking about what you were saying this week, there's a relationship between the area and numbers of degrees of freedom.
Well, I think of it. I think of it as the question is, what do you need to show what? So, what I haven't said this yet, but what I have in mind very often is using one of Ted Jacobson's two different derivations from a short list of principles to the Einstein equation, and so I'm looking to use that as a schematic. And the question is, what do I need to make Ted's argument work? And as far as I can tell, I only need the weak version of the statement. That is, just in case, so that this is said once, a strong version of the holographic statement, or the Bekenstein bound, gives you a bound on the dimension of a Hilbert space of states interior to a black hole as a function of the area of its horizon. A weak version gives you a bound on the capacity of the horizon as a channel of information to the area. And
yeah,
so
it's, I was more asking in the context of causal, like this energetic causal set where I only have energy, so I don't yet have locality or position
right.
Variable like the area. So at some point, you know, implementing the weak, doesn't that mean that if you want to implement the weak holographic principle, you have to kind of reestablish that duality? That is, you have to kind of find within this fundamental structure something geometrical.
Yes, of course.
So then I was asking,
Well, so we're not very advanced. In the simplest case, which I showed in the slides, we can reconstruct embeddings in the Minkowski space. We can wave our hands and talk about putting parallel transport degrees of freedom on the causal relation and having that deform the geometry to give us something like general relativity. But we have not worked through the details of that all the way.
So wouldn't you say, in some sense, to reconcile these first three principles with weaker local holography, you have to kind of reconcile both sides of the duality?
Yes. I would say that.
Okay.
But still, it's important, for example, for meanwhile, in another part of the theory, I'm working on explaining quantum mechanics in terms of non-local interactions. And it's important for that part of the theory to work that those dynamics are defined in a regime where there is no embedding in space, because otherwise they look quite non-local. So I'm trying to do that and this at the same time.
Last questions for Rafael.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask about the Bohmian potential, but maybe that's a more technical discussion. So let me ask a very general question instead. I wonder whether this final move that you made to go from elements of a causal set and their growth and so on, which has a lot of temporality in your sense of time. I mean, it's an active process. But then you switch to these views of all of the elements. That looks much more to me like some black universe point of view. You just have all these views, and then you can maybe assemble them in such a way that shows some kind of causal order.
Mm-hmm.
But what seems to be lost, at least it wasn't in your description, was the process of coming into being of these views.
Yes, we haven't done much to define that yet in terms of the views. I think we haven't done anything. But what we imagine is that there is a present set of views which adds to it that there is a process, something like your growth dynamics, which adds views and subtracts them when they become go into the past, so that there's always a dynamics among a present set.
Yeah, so I don't know, Rafael, if you'd call it a block universe, but at least the causal set is highly time asymmetric and
asymmetric.
Or causal.
Right.
Causal. So what the thick present events have, which you might call a block universe, but we hope it's not the same as a block universe, is they have a memory of the past. And that could be in terms of records or fossils, or every event carries a measure of its lineage. I hope it's not the same.
You're still imagining these events coming into being. So there's a thick present, then there's another thick present.
Wouldn't it be that you have a thick present for each event? Like there is not. In this picture, I don't see how you have a global present that is what that brings time, or even the notion of block universe is somehow associated.
You are an event or its view are in the thick present if you have not been part of the creation of more than a certain number of new events, which is part of the specification of the theory. So in the 1+1 dimensional models, we usually choose that to be 2. So you get to be the progenitor of 2 events, and then you're in the past.
So each event happening has a common beginning in this picture. That's why then you can.
I think we don't usually have a comment. We usually
It seems because it seems you were mentioning the idea that there is what you call it the memory. So each event has a memory of the past. And my question was that isn't this memory different for each observer? If you want every event in the universe to have a common present, a common memory, means that they should be all together.
They have one past, and they are the only ones that know their past. Other events have their own past, so the past looks different to each person. Like,
okay, very good.
Just to clarify the question. So what's the difference? What's the significance of switching from the one point of view to the other point, the view point of view, from the element, new sig present coming into being? I can understand that, but does using this past view formulation, does that lead to a different kind of dynamics? It's hard for me to see the difference if you see between the two.
That's an excellent question, and I'd be happy to discuss that with you later. Because that would take us in a whole other direction.
Okay, so thank you again.
Thank you very much.